Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the, I think, the sixth talk of the Range Retreat. It's also the last talk I will give for a couple of weeks because I'll be entering my personal retreat on next Sunday evening. And as such, that the next couple of Wednesdays I will not be giving a talk here. Usually I try to structure the talks in a Range Retreat, as in any retreat, even for lay people, to make sure the first part of the instructions are focused on one thing and one thing only, which is the development of samadhi. The triple practice which the Buddha kept talking about was sila, samadhi, panya. And in this monastery, especially at this time of the year, the whole community is keeping a very sufficient practice of sila. Your restraint, your keeping the precepts is admirable. And so usually one doesn't really need to talk too much about that. You will find that keeping solitude is one of the best ways of encouraging the maintenance of the precepts. The more that people meet together and talk together and associate together, not just the more opportunity is there for breaking precepts, but it arouses those defilements of the mind which are the cause for the precepts being broken. In solitude, the precepts are less likely to be broken. Even those precepts which can be broken by yourself because the stimulation of being amongst other people, being in company, is absent, they're less likely to occur. So at this time of solitude, this time of monks being alone, being quiet, not engaging in conversations, not doing so much, it's a time of great purity of your precepts. Which is why that I focus on this first half of the retreat about using whatever tools, skillful means, whatever tricks which I've learnt in my lifetime as a meditator, to try and encourage, inspire, and to try and instruct on the path to develop deeper and deeper samadhi. The purpose of samadhi is to overcome the five hindrances and to give the data for which insight can work on. But that data and the insight will come later on in this retreat. Sometimes that people rush ahead of themselves and start thinking and forming views about such reality before they've even had the experience of such things like jhanas. And as such, that such speculation is just merely that. It's papancha, it's ideas, it's maybes, it's fantasies, it's dreams. And so I usually like to leave that until much later. But here, that the idea of overcoming these five hindrances is so important, because it is the five hindrances which block the door to both jhanas and to wisdom. It is the five hindrances which fuel avijja. The Buddha said they're the nutriments, the food of delusion. And so if those five hindrances are still present in a person, you cannot trust your ideas, you cannot trust your views. It's one of those truths, self-evident truths, that everybody thinks they're right. There's not a person in this world who would say they have wrong view. We always think they're right. If they're wrong, then in that sense they're right. They've finally seen they're wrong. What they really say is, I was wrong. No one can ever say, I am wrong. If you think about that for a while, they say, I am wrong. And if that's really true, it means that they're right. Because if they say I'm wrong, they're mistaken. So it must be in the right. If they're right, they cannot be wrong. It's a logical impossibility. That's philosophy, and that's as far as I'm going with philosophy in this talk. But everyone believes they're right. And this was something fascinating to contemplate in some of the early years of my monastic life. Why is it that good monks argue? And that people in this world have differences of opinion? And you can see the reason why that is because of the work of the five hindrances, which bend reality, which bend perception, which bend thoughts, which bend view to suit its purposes. In psychology we call it denial. We see what we want to see. We perceive what we think is there. And that's why there are so many people in this world committed, absolutely sure, absolutely certain that they are on the right path. Even as people committed, absolutely believing that they're stream winners, non-returners, arahats in this world. And they cannot see because of the power of hindrances. So those hindrances are so important to actually to know and to overcome. And there's an acid test to know those hindrances are overcome. The acid test is the ability to enter into a jhana. Because the hindrances are those things which block jhanas. And if those hindrances are absent, really absent, then using a simile of entering into a building, into a house, the door is wide open and there's nothing stopping, nothing barring the person entering into those states of absorption. That's why these things are called hindrances. They hinder not only wisdom, they not only fuel avijja, delusion, but they also hinder and block the passage into jhanas. And it's using that criteria which not only tell you whether you're ready to develop wisdom yet, the enlightening wisdom, whether you're ready to actually to look at the nature of things like the mind or the body or the sense bases or the khandhas. Not only does it show that whether you're ready or not to do these things, but it also actually shows you what these things actually are and how subtle they can be. And so often that people think that the hindrances are overcome, but they're not, because they're far away from entering into a jhana. And so that is the acid test, and which is one of the reasons why that I can't see any reason why a person would stop at the entrance into a jhana and say, this is good enough, now I can contemplate, now I can find out. Usually a person, the usual practice, the common practice, would be get those hindrances suppressed and having the, as it were, the door of jhana right open to you, and the jhana happens. The jhana sucks you in, or sucks the mind in, sucks the awareness in. And as such, it showed you that, yes, that was the state where the hindrances were overcome. As I was talking with someone recently, that it's a moot point whether you could stop anyway at the gate into jhanas. As I've mentioned on many occasions on the Wednesday evening talks, that there comes a time in the practice of samadhi where a snowball effect happens, where you can neither stop the process nor can you accelerate it, but where you become just an observer of this wonderful focusing of the mind, this wonderful abandoning of the world. And that snowball effect gets stronger and stronger, in the same way that a snowball rolling down the hill, you might be able to stop it at the top of the hill somewhere. When it gets right down to the goal, to the bottom, to the valleys, but it's so big, it's so fast, I can't see how it can be stopped. And that is why that which we call upachara samadhi, the state outside of jhanas where there are no hindrances, that upachara samadhi which first arises, I cannot see how the mind can stop and linger there. the process will push it through. And so that is a sign that, yeah, that was the state without hindrances. And once one emerges from that jhana, then those hindrances stay knocked out for a long time. They are suppressed. As the Nalakapana Sutta so beautifully states in the Majjhima Nikaya, the teachings of the Buddha, which every good monk acknowledges. Those teachings say that if the jhana has not been achieved, the five hindrances, together with what you might even call hindrance number 6 and 7, arati, which is discontent, and tandi, which is the sluggishness, stiffness of the body and the mind. They sometimes call it weariness and discontent. They invade the mind and remain. But when the jhana has been achieved, these things don't invade the mind, they don't remain. There is a freedom there from the hindrances. And that's why that's been classically the time when deep insight has happened. The insight which gives rise to the paths and the fruits. And it happens because not only the five hindrances overcome, but the mind can look back upon those experiences, as it says in the suttas, standing on those experiences, resting on those, based on those experiences. You have the data to actually to see into the nature of the mind, the body, the nature in of these five khandhas, the nature of the sense basis. Without that data, it's very hard to imagine how anyone could see the truth. So that it's important to have those five hindrances overcome, and also to use that state of the jhanas, what overcomes the hindrances, as also the place where one focuses one's investigation to be able to discover why and where and how those states came about and what they mean. So the five hindrances are the key to this whole practice, which we call liberation of the mind. And so those five hindrances, that you've heard of them before, but they can always be repeated and explained in deeper and deeper levels. Remember, these five hindrances are not just the ordinary sensory desire, ill will, restlessness and remorse, sloth and torpor and doubt. Because it happens very easily that sometimes you look at your mind, I've got no sensory desire. I don't really want anything. I've got no lust or greed. I'm not looking for a cup of tea or for food or looking for women or whatever. I've got no real will towards anybody or towards myself or to anything. I've got no real restlessness or sloth and torpor. I've got no real doubt, so I know I'm right. So, very often that happens. But that's not sufficient, because you know from that state you can't get into jhanas. That's why I tell people, if when you're meditating, if there's a blockage there, if you can't get further, it must be one of the hindrances, one of the niwaranas. And to be methodical in the meditation practice, so you don't waste so much time, discover which hindrance it is. So then you identify the problem and you can actually find some solution. I've got tremendous faith in the Buddha's teaching. If there were 6 hindrances or 7 hindrances or 8 hindrances, the Buddha would have said it. The 5 hindrances, or you might call with arati and tandi as well, but really the 5 hindrances, the usual list, is sufficient to describe all the obstacles between the meditator and jhana. Sufficient description. So we should look at those and investigate them. And as usual, the most important comes first. Karma chanda. And it's not just sensory desire. Sometimes that the English translations of these terms leave so much to be desired. And people just follow those English translations and they miss so much. The Pali, Kama Chanda. Now the word Chanda, a lot of the Pali I learned was learning it from the Vinaya, because there it took these terms and gave them a practical explanation, because they were used in ordinary life. The Chanda was what you do, what you have to give if you cannot attend a meeting of the community of monks and you want to give your approval, your agreement to what's happening there. You give your Chanda to go ahead in your absence. It's agreement, approval, consent. It's much more subtle than mere desire. This means you're buying into this, you're giving into this, you want it, you approve of it, you allow it to happen. In the same way that we have that Chanda in the Vinaya, we have like Karma Chanda. It's like you give your approval for the sensory world to be in your consciousness, in your mind. You accept it, you approve it, you play with it. That's all Chanda. So it's much more subtle than just mere desire. It's just letting it completely occupy the mind. And the karma part of the Chanda, that's like all that is comprised in Karma Loka, the world of the five senses, which goes from the hell realms, the animal realms, the ghost realms, the human realm, the deva realms, anything which is concerned with those realms is Karma Loka. And Karma Chanda is like acceptance, agreement, consent for that world to occupy you. And that's why that the Karma Chanda, the hindrance there of Karma Chanda, is anything from the extremes of lust to just being concerned with how the body is doing. So thinking about the letter which you have to write afterwards, to thinking about the rain pattering on your roof, to thinking about the kuti or what needs to be built next or where you're going to go next. That's all in the Karma Loka world. That's all Karma Chanda. And they have the refined form of Karma Vitaka, the thoughts about those things. It can be thoughts about family, it can be thoughts about health, thoughts about going here, coming there, thoughts about words. Words are sounds. It's part of the sadda base. But all these things are part of Karma Loka, part of the five sense world. And so approving of those things is what keeps these things interfering with your meditation. When you are trying to watch the breath and the feelings in the body come up, is because you're approving of the mind going out to the body. You're consenting to it. You're allowing it to happen. Very often one of the great antidotes to Chanda is Nibbida. This turning away, this repulsion, this revulsion, from that world. That's why the Buddha gave some very meaningful similes for Karma Loka, for the world of sensory desire. And I think we're just talking about this with one of the monks the other day. My favourite simile is the bone smeared with blood, which is tossed to a hungry dog. And that's so apt for the sensory world. And you pay attention to it and you get a taste of comfort, just for a moment. You scratch the itch and it just feels good just for a moment, but it doesn't really solve the underlying problem. In the same way, when a dog gets a bone smeared with blood, it licks it and it tastes as if it's a full meal, as if it's real meat. And of course, you just get the taste, but then there's no real sustenance there, there's no real body to it. It never really gives you the fulfillment which it promises. And that's with sensory desire. In its grossest form in the world, whether it's sexuality or food or whatever else that you desire, it will never give you satisfaction. And don't be a person who roams the world looking for the next bone smeared with blood. You go here, you get a bone smeared with blood, oh, that's not the right one. So you go to another monastery and taste that, that's not the right one. No, that's not the right one. Always running around looking for that real meat. Because you don't find that real meat in that sensory world. It only, well, I think what the sutta says, it only leads to weariness and disappointment. So all the weariness and disappointment which comes up in your life, why? It's because one is trying to go for bones which are just smeared with blood. Not the real full course meal, which happens when you give up those things. Now the other simile which one of the monks said, which was very fascinating, was that simile of the man climbing a tree to get some fruit. And while he's up in the tree, another guy comes along, also wanting the fruit, and chops the tree down. Saying even if it's unintentional, that when you go for sensory, the sensory world, it's just by its very nature, it's going to hurt and destroy and bring you pain. Just last night, just giving a talk about conflict in the world. Basically, there's no end to conflict in the world. That's what the world is about, conflict. And trying to resolve that conflict in the world is just impossible. To limit it is possible, but to stop it completely is impossible. There's this old saying in English, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And this is samsara is like that. That's why the Buddha said the Four Noble Truths. The first one is samsara is suffering. And the idea is to get out of this samsara, to get out of conflict by not getting reborn again. Once you're born, you have conflict. You have arguments with people. You'll have conflict with the weather. You'll have conflict with the food. Or the food will have conflict with your stomach. There's all sorts of conflicts go on in the world. I had a stomach ache today, so I know about conflicts with the food and my stomach. That's par for the course. So, understanding that sensory world is dangerous. Even if there's people have no intention to hurt or to harm or to cause you problem or to irritate you. It's the nature of this sensory world. If you climb up into it, sooner or later someone is going to, with no bad intention towards you, is going to cut you down from the roots and almost kill you and harm you and hurt you. That's why sometimes we get angry at others. Why we have ill will towards others. Because we think people do this on purpose. They don't do these things on purpose. It's just being in the world. If you're up a tree, and sooner or later, if you stay long enough up a tree, someone's going to come up with a chainsaw, probably Ajahnjana, and cut you down. There's no bad intentions there. Ajahnjana's a great monk, a very wonderful monk. But it just happens, that's what you do. So this is just the nature of that sensory world. It's dangerous. So if you play around in that world, you're going to get into trouble. So that gives you that nibbida. Nibbida to climbing up into that world. It gets nibbida for biting at the bones, which promise you so much but give you nothing. And that nibbida towards the sensory realm, which is not just towards the physical body. You can see it as asupa. The result of asupa is nibbida, turning away from it. It's also the nibbida towards sound. And all these things you hear from other people, praise and blame, nibbida towards both. Nibbida to yak, yak, yak. Nibbida towards the frog mouth owl. Nibbida towards the train. Nibbida towards the truck noise. Nibbida towards everything which is sound. Nibbida towards sights, nibbida towards smells and to tastes. So all this food which we have, it's such a problem. Remember, I think Ajahn Jayasaro years ago, when he was just simple Jayasaro, said, wouldn't it be great if we can get some of this astronaut food? Because he heard it was just a couple of pills you take. And just put these couple of pills, one for protein, one for vitamins, one for carbohydrates, and just take the pills rather than having all this different types of food which need to be cooked and prepared and set out and then eaten. Be great, wouldn't it, if we just take pills once a day? And we can have a breakfast pill and you can have a before lunch pill if you really want to. And it'd be great that all these monks were taking the bowls to the white people on retreat. They wouldn't have so much to carry. Just a little medicine bottle. Here's your dana for today. And it'd be wonderful because it takes away all of the nibbida, all the problem which goes with tastes. What that really does is actually turn you away from that world. So you're not concerned about it. Just put food in your bowl, eat it. You know, you see things, you just leave them alone. You turn away from all of that. And that nibbida, which is revulsion from that world, is a way of turning off those five senses. Instead of having karma chanda, you have karma nibbida. And karma nibbida, just revulsion from that world. How long have you lived in that world? What has it ever given you? Where have you ever got from that world? Just problems. Just all it's ever given you is old age, suffering and death. And old age, suffering and death. And old age, suffering and death. Again and again and again. It's giving you all sorts of problems. If I've ever given you a problem, don't blame me. It's karma that's given the problem. Sensory world. If it's the body's giving you a problem, sickness. It's not sickness, it's karma. The sensory world. This is what the sensory world is. So get nibbida towards it. Getting nibbida towards the sensory realm will turn off, will be the antidote to that hindrance. And not only will it stop you indulging in thoughts about these things of the past, so not only will it stop you indulging in the experience of the senses now, but also it will stop you thinking about them, planning about them. Why do we actually do any planning? Because we think that we can control that world and get happiness. Well, you know, it's just a hopeless task. The whole thing stinks, so just throw it all away. You don't even worry about thinking in the future because you know it's going to be bad. It's not going to give you much happiness. It's going to be more trouble, more problems. Being an abbot, you don't control anything. You're letting yourself have more troubles, more problems. Being a second monk, third monk, junior monk, just more problems, more trouble in the sensory realm, because that's what it is. So you don't even plan or think about the future when you're meditating. Nibbida towards all of that. The same way you get nibbida towards the food. You only eat it because it sustains the body. It's your duty. You sleep because it's your duty. You know, just keep the body reasonably healthy, middle way. It's the Buddha's way. With nibbida towards those five senses, the five senses are very easy to turn off. Which means that when you're meditating, feelings in the body just don't come up. You're fed up with trying to get this body into a nice position. What happened to me early on in my monastic life. I didn't know whether it was when I was a lay meditator or a monk meditator. I was sitting down and my legs went to sleep. I had pins and needles. Every time that happened, I would move, destroy my meditation, until one day I decided I have had enough of this. I had nibbida towards always having to change because my body, or rather my legs, went to sleep. I decided, right, it doesn't matter if they die or gangrene sets in or whatever. And I just sat there, and to my amazement, I called the bluff of the body. All of the blood started flowing again, and the pins and needles went by themselves. Other times people have called the bluff of the body. They've been sitting there and aching and pains. They just forgot about it and got into deep meditation, and afterwards the aches and pains aren't there. These aches and pains in the body, are they really aches and pains, or are they product of the mind? Because you can sit meditation for hours. There's no aches and pains at all when you come out. You can sit there for an hour and a half without any samadhi, and your body aches and it's stiff. What's going on? So after a while you lose confidence that the body tells the truth. You lose confidence that the sights tell the truth. that the ears tell the truth, that the nose or the tongue tells the truth. Nibbida towards all of that. And it means these things don't interfere with you. A sound comes up, you're just not concerned. Nibbida. Turning away from these things. And it's the same with like ill will, the second hindrance which comes up. That ill will is one of the most stupid hindrances. It's a crazy hindrance. I don't know why people actually get bothered with ill will. Because what does it ever do for you? If someone else upsets you, someone else says something you don't like, someone else does something which you don't approve of, just why allow them to sort of give you a bad day? Now, you don't have to allow them to spoil your happiness. Even if it's ill will towards something else. What does that actually achieve by having ill will towards them? They're just trying for revenge. They hurt me, therefore I'm going to hurt them. And go around planning or trying to make ways of trying to upset them or put them down. So much of actually speech, especially confrontation, is just trying to give another person a bad day. And that ill will, it doesn't really help anybody. If someone else has done something wrong, if they really had, you know, broken their precepts or broken what's appropriate, it's their problem. It's karma's problem. Karma will sort everything out. You don't have to have ill will towards them. And that ill will, when actually you see it, it's wasted so much time in your life. You haven't got much time to practice this path. Now we've got the best time of all, the meditation retreat. There's not many distractions for you. Why waste it with the distraction of ill will? Now, even outside of the retreat, when we're doing things, there's even less time to meditate. So why waste even a second with ill will? It's craziness. I think the Buddha described it as a sickness. And so with that sickness, there's no way you can get any wisdom. There's no way that you can get any happiness, any meditation, concentration. So put that aside. Use your insight. You know, just your intelligence to see that ill will gets you nowhere. And just put it aside. Have nibbida towards this. Just reflect on just how much time it's wasted you. And how it's tortured you, how it's made you sick and weak. And then it can disappear. Of course, I've mentioned before in some of those talks, that ill will goes very deep. It's the ill will which stops you having happiness, which doesn't allow you happiness, which can get very aggressive. There's that story which is in the adapted from the Udana, the anger-eating demon, which I'm not going to go into detail here, because you've probably heard me say this so many times, the anger-eating demon. You give it anger and it gets stronger. You give it aggression. That's why kill the defilements. Box them. Flatten them around a bit. A lot of times, if you try that with ill will, it gets even worse. It's coming from the sense of self. It's ill will towards ill will. It's not the way. The Buddha said, metta, loving kindness, is a way to overcome that defilement, not ill will. That's why the monks on the river Raghumuda, doing Asupagamatan, got into so much ill will towards themselves, they committed suicide. And the Buddha had to say, monks, that's the wrong way. Balance your practice. Asupa-meditation is great for lessening, suppressing sensory desire. But ill will needs loving kindness, needs the softness of the mind. And that needs to be looked at in one's meditation. Often I say that people in this monastery don't get deeper in their meditation. One of the biggest blockages is ill will towards themselves. Ill will towards the meditation object. Not ill will towards others, you can see that very easily. What this actually means is when you're meditating, when you're watching the breath, say, you have ill will towards that breath. In other words, you're going to conquer that breath. You're going to use your macho power. I'm stronger than you. Grab hold of it, just like some bouncer at a nightclub. This is the way I'm going to capture the breath, and I'm going to keep you there. That aggression is ill will. And you'll find you may be able to hold the breath for a short time. But because of maybe anicca, as soon as you loosen your grip, that breath is going to run away, and it's going to run fast and not come back. Just the whole stress of that will never allow the mind to settle down. That's why it is wonderful in one's meditation from time to time to interrupt it with some loving kindness, even a minute of loving kindness in meditation. I don't mean in the deep meditations by doing "may all beings be happy" as a verbal exercise. Just remember what loving kindness means. And bring up the mood of loving kindness. Bring it up into the mind. And soften the mind with that. And with that aroma of loving kindness, the mood of loving kindness, just place that on the breath. And so you're meditating on the breath with metta. And metta and anapanasati just come together as one. Just you're watching the breath, just so softly. And you find the breath stays then. You're not trying to grab hold of it. You're not holding it down with force. You're not fighting it like a soldier. You're being like a Buddha. Compassionate. And with that compassion, that kindness, that softness, you find it's much easier to hold the breath and much easier to get into deeper meditation. You know, I remember one time when I was starting a meditation retreat, just a weekend one, and on a Friday evening, tired from all the work I'd done, getting to that meditation retreat, giving a talk, and then after the talk, you know, spending a little bit of time, okay, now's the time I can do some meditation. It was marvellous actually putting metta on the breath. You're going to such a wonderful deep meditation. And even during the night I dreamt of deep meditation. Got up in the morning and just the nimitta was right there as soon as you wake up. It was, you know, marvellous to be able to put that loving kindness together with the breath. It was obvious that evening, maybe because of tiredness, my hindrance was ill will. But I spotted it and gave it the antidote, and amazing results. So when actually you can see these hindrances and actually put forth the right antidote, it's amazing what happens. And of course, the only real way you can know whether it's ill will is to try metta. And if it works, you know, that was ill will. And then after a while you can know what that ill will can truly be is a very subtle hindrance. Only through the practice of the antidote. If it works, you know, that was ill will. Because that ill will which I had that evening, I couldn't really see it. I couldn't recognize it as ill will. I just had some intuition to do some loving kindness, and it worked. But the way that ill will manifests, sometimes you just can't notice it. It's almost invisible. But apply the remedy into the meditation, immediately goes deeper. Then you know, that was ill will. And it's also, you can see how this becomes a hindrance to wisdom. So many of these hindrances are so subtle. They are like the invisible man, they're like ghosts. They block the way, but you can't really see them blocking the way. And they're sort of that refined and subtle. But the remedies which the Buddha gave were the ones which work. And when it gets the udicca, kukicca, the restlessness of the mind. And you all know this one, when you're meditating and just the mind goes backwards and forwards, you're trying to make it stop. Thinking and going here and going there, but it just won't go anywhere. It's very close to ill will. But however, if you really look deeper, you'll find that it's not really just ill will, it's just this mind which has got into fault finding. It's a lack of contentment. And that's why that word contentment is so powerful. If loving kindness doesn't work, just try the contentment. They're so close together. With the anger eating demon, the contentment is, demon, you can be here as long as you like. If the mind is wandering backwards and forwards, allow it to wander backwards and forwards. You can wander wherever you want, mind. I'm completely content. What it actually does, it takes away the force which keeps the mind moving. What is that force? It's always discontent, wanting something else, wanting somewhere else, but never really wanting what's happening here, because you judge this to be wrong, not good enough. The mind is wandering all over the place, this is not good enough. And with contentment, you say, okay, just leave it. And what arises passes away. The mind will slow down by itself. Contentment is undermining the doer. And that's very difficult to actually to see that. But when you apply contentment more and more and more, deeper and deeper and deeper, you'll find that's an incredibly powerful tool to get you into deep samadhi. Just watching the breath, you're just content to be on this rough old breath which you're on now. Absolutely content. You don't want anything else in the whole world ever. It's to be here now with this rotten old breath. You try that. It's called letting go. With that full contentment, it's like climbing on the bus and everything happens. Fully letting go of this rotten old breath, it won't stay still, thinking about all these sorts of things. With full contentment, I give up. What that happens then is because the doer, the thing creating the problem, has been seen. Mara, I know you. It's discontent, fault finding. I'm not going to follow you, I'm not going to buy into you. Contentment. Whatever you want to do, off you go. What that does, Mara says, I've been seen, and slinks away with shoulders hunched. The monk knows me. What that metaphor means is the disturbance slinks away with shoulders hunched. The mind settles. Because of contentment, there's no reason to make the mind move. It's Ajahn Chah's simile of the leaf fluttering on the tree. You've removed the wind. Contentment has removed the wind of discontent, of doing. And when that wind has been removed, little by little, the leaf flutters less and less. The mind settles down. The breath settles down. And before you know it, you're just watching the beautiful breath. Just so content to be with the beautiful breath, because that contentment becomes the inclination of the mind. It becomes established in the mind. You'd be so content that just the beautiful breath just turns into a nimitta, but you don't care. You're just so content if the nimitta comes or if it goes. However long it wants to stay, it can stay. You're just so content. You're not forcing the issue, you're not driving the meditation. You've let go. And because of that contentment, the nimitta doesn't move. Because it doesn't move, it builds up energy. More and more and more. You get into the first jhana. Contentment still keeps on working to overcome the vitakka vichara. And then one has the full contentment of ajatang sampasadana. The full contentment inside of the second jhana. That's how far contentment can take you. Powerful antidote to restlessness, to that which moves the mind, which makes it wobble. In the first jhana. So that's the antidote to restlessness. Know that restlessness is because you're always just finding fault, critical. Those monks are always critical, always finding fault, either with other people, with the monastery, with this or with that. You can know that they'll never find contentment in the world. They go to another monastery, they take the fault finding mind with them. They won't be content there. Even if they go to a monastery, if they can find the Jeta Grove and the Buddha is sitting there. Ah, just Indian. You just won't be content there either. So it's just that fault finding mind. Opposite contentment. That word contentment has a feel to it. When you practice contentment a lot in the meditation, it's not just a word. It's a whole territory in the mind. And it's a territory, it's a place, a path which leads into the deep meditations. It's a very, very beautiful word. The more you reflect upon it, the more you allow it to lead you, the more you'll know just how powerful it is as a path into the deep meditations. And also shows you the path of an arahat, absolutely content. And the hindrance of kukkha, very close to the hindrance of doubt. Remorse, you know, the remorse about things which you've done, which you shouldn't have done. You all know the way to stop that. Forgiveness, let it go. Everyone makes mistakes. In this world, no one is perfect because the world isn't perfect. That's why. It's because Rupa Kanda isn't perfect, because Vedana Kanda isn't perfect, because Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana Kanda isn't perfect. So what do you expect? Any monk, any kangaroo are the same. They're not perfect. They're Kandas. So forgive and let go. Path of the Course. Sloth and torpor. There's a negativity of trying to escape through sleep. When I used to visit the prisons, because prisons were a very unpleasant place for people to stay in, one of the common phrases was an hour of sleep was an hour off your sentence. But here, an hour of extra sleep is an hour of wasted opportunity. Sloth and torpor shows you're not really enjoying what you're doing. There's no happiness in the practice. A supagamatan, the loathsomeness of things, can quite easily lead to that sloth and torpor. Be careful there. Unless you develop a supa to the point that it arouses piti sukha. If it just arises negativity, the mind will be inclined to go into sloth, into torpor. After a while, just energy arises in the mind. Just because it enjoys meditating. Don't always look at the clocks. Just look at the present moment instead. The clocks can create sloth and torpor. It's 10 o'clock, it's 11 o'clock, it's my bedtime now. And you start to yawn. If you don't look at the clock, who knows what time it is? And once when I was a lay person, I went to the far north of Norway in the Arctic Circle. It was light all day and night, 24 hours, it never changed. It really confused me. I didn't know when it was the right time to sleep. It's marvellous actually to get all the monks to go up there for a rains retreat. You find you have extra energy up there. Because you know, why sleep when it's light? You'd only sleep when the body tells you it's really tired. Not just when it's dark, or not just when it's your bedtime. That's why in this monastery we don't have morning and evening meetings. I don't want you to be prisoners of clocks. I want you to be free of that. So when the meditation's going well, go for it. When it's time to rest, rest. Sometimes, and if you push yourself too much, sometimes you just get into sloth and torpor. It's much better if a person has clarity of mind and not so much meditation, then they have hardly any sleep and they have a dull mind all day. Be careful there, because I've been through that myself. Try to cut down on sleep to the point that you get up in the morning and you just nod or you fall asleep sitting up. There's not enough sleep. Well, be careful to have too much sleep, and again you get sloth and torpor. You get that right amount of sleep, the right amount of food, the right amount of exercise, the right amount of happiness in your life. Then you don't have too much sloth and torpor. So negative people they often have sloth and torpor. Those with the positive attitudes have energy. And of course, the last hindrance of doubt. This is the opposite of sloth and torpor, I say, is happiness. Because happiness is energy. Bring up joy in your mind. So if you have sloth and torpor, bring up a subha-nimitta, a happy, a joyful object of the mind. If you enjoy chanting, chant. If you enjoy walking, walk. If you enjoy sitting, sit. If you enjoy reading, read. That enjoyment, and I'm not talking about sensory enjoyment, don't go thinking about women. Because what I won't tell you who it was, one of the monks did once in a monastery in Thailand. And he said, no sloth and torpor, no restlessness at all. But that's not the way to overcome those hindrances. Just one hindrance is being substituted by another one. So do it with a wholesome object which brings happiness, which brings joy. Chaganusati is one of my favourites. Reflecting on all the sacrifice, all the goodness which I have done. As one monk reminded me today, just reflecting on all the wonderful people who came for my birthday. And just the fact that they came because I'd done something for them. I gave something for them. That's why they came. So it's my chaga, my generosity, my giving, which caused that. So I can reflect upon that instead of with negativity. Just having to have a birthday again. Why is my birthday during the rains retreat? It's really unfair. Why can't it be some other time when we're busy anyway? But no, just to have the positive attitude, to reflect upon that with chaga, and that gives energy. I must admit though, I forgot to do that. So I was negative to my birthday celebrations. But I should have done next time chaga. Isn't it wonderful that so many people come? It gives so many wonderful birthday cakes. Maybe that positive energy gives you happiness and joy, which overcomes sloth and torpor. So it's happiness through a subha-nimitta, anything which gives you happiness and joy, which energizes the mind. And lastly, vicikicca, the doubt. That doubt is for thinking too much. When you think too much, you will always have doubts. Where is thinking? Thinking goes in two ways. Vicikicca is the prefix vi means going into a fork, doubting. Could it be this way? Could it be that way? It's duality. When there's no duality, when there's a unity of mind, then doubt cannot happen. So you just give yourself up to the instructions. Sometimes that doubt can come up when we contemplate the Dhamma rather than contemplate the path. When we contemplate the goal rather than the way to the goal. Because the way to the goal is quite clear. And it's where everybody agrees on that way to the goal, especially in our tradition. But what you actually see there when you get there, people have differences of opinion. And it's a waste of time having those differences of opinion, what you see when you get there. Get there first of all and see for yourself. So don't waste time having doubts about the goal, what's going to be there. You know it's good. The Buddha went there and said it's a nice place to go to, this thing we call Nibbana. So follow the path there. And have confidence that this is the path of the Aryas. It's a path you see in the suttas. It's a path which leads to Nibbana. It's a gradual path, meaning it gets gradually better and better, more and more power, more and more happiness, more and more profundity. The feeling you're getting closer and closer to something which is very amazing, very wonderful, liberating. Getting closer and closer to what you've always wanted. The more you meditate, the closer you get, and the more sure you get that this is the path. Vicikicca is overcome gradually through practice, through the experience of what's happening. And eventually you get your first experience of like a jhana, and all vicikicca about what you need to do is usually abandoned. Don't you actually see what's going on there with this mind or with this body? All doubt goes. So you know what to do. So there's no messing around. There's no wobbling. There's no faltering. There's no hesitation. This is what I've got to do. Get in there and do it. Those are hindrances to one's meditation practice. Five in number. Whatever's stopping you from enjoying the deepest of meditations, it has to be one of those five hindrances, or a combination. If it's a combination, one will be prominent. So don't mess around. Know the obstacle, know the remedy, and apply it. In applying that remedy, you'll also be practicing Dhammanusati, the fourth Satipatthana, getting to know what these hindrances are. The reason why that Dhammanusati leads to deep insights is because these are refined forms of craving, refined forms of upadana. The five hindrances are manifestations of these things. And people in the world say all sorts of stupid things about what upadana and what craving is. Here you're seeing through bare experience what these things are. You're not just reading the menus, you're tasting the food. And when you see what craving is and just how pernicious it is, how difficult it is to track down, it's really slippery. But once you actually see it through the eradication of the five hindrances, and each one of these five hindrances is a manifestation of craving, once you actually see that, you understand how craving, again, is so deep, and why it is so hard to uproot, and why the way to uproot it is only through this practice of the Eightfold Path culminating in jhanas. So this is the insights you get on the way in, through contemplating these five hindrances, knowing them so well that when you know them completely, you know the antidotes, you become one, as they say in the suttas, can enter jhana with no difficulty, at ease, with no trouble. You know the way in, you know the obstacles, you know the remedies. Why should there be any difficulty? So please bear these words in mind in the next 2 or 3 weeks. You're just focusing on the practice which leads to jhana, and on the way having some very powerful insights into the nature of craving and upadana. So may you bear these words in mind, and may they bear fruit in your practice. That's it. Any questions or comments? Okay.
Bhagavato Stavaka Sangho Sangha.